call to order this hearing, the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Oversight, Monday, February 15th. We have the minutes from January 20th hearing. Senator Lori moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion or corrections? All those in favor, please say aye. Opposed? No. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have the minutes from February 5th. Senator Lori moves adoption of the minutes from February 5th. Are there any corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes from February 5th are adopted. We have the minutes from February 8th. Any corrections to the minutes from February 8th?
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry.
I just noticed here, going back to February 5th and February 8th, I know some people think I look like Dick Day, but I'm certainly not, and I was present at both those meetings, the 5th and the 8th.
We will. That's a glitch we have with the computer program. We'll change that. Or we did. Have we done it? For this one? Okay. So let's go back to reconsider that motion for February 5th. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Let the record show that the correction on the minutes for February 5th, that Senator Michael Perry was present, and obviously not Senator Dick Day. So we have Senator Lori's motion to approve the minutes as corrected. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Adopted. Same reconsideration for February 8th. Senator Lori moves reconsideration. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion is adopted. Senator Lori moves the same correction as the minutes for February 5th and moves that the minutes be adopted as corrected. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Motion prevails. Then we have the minutes from February 12th, which are correct. With regard to attendance, are there corrections to the minutes from February 12th? Seeing none, Senator Lori moves adoption of the minutes from February 12th. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Motion prevails. Senator Prettner-Solon. Senator Prettner-Solon brings us on Senate File 2397, and if the bill is acted on favorably, it will move to the floor.
Okay.
Senator Prettner-Solon, you want to tell us about Senate File 2397?
Sure. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 2397 amends the enabling statute for the Spirit Mountain Recreation Authority in Duluth. And specifically, we're looking to expand the number of members on the authority's board from 7 to 9. The Spirit Mountain Authority has embarked on a strategic planning process, which is placing significant demands on the board of directors. By expanding the board, we will bring more community members into the planning and decision-making process, and the burden will be shared by more people in the community. The directors are appointed by the mayor and they're approved by the city council. And I have with me Renee Mattson, who is the executive director of the Spirit Mountain Recreation Area Authority, who can describe briefly the work that the authority is undertaking.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Renee Mattson, executive director, Spirit Mountain Recreation Area.
Ms. Mattson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Spirit Mountain begins the process of building itself into a true year-round resort, Additional board members are really necessary to assist with committee work and to help propel Spirit Mountain to the next level of economic development. As we've begun tackling projects outlined in our updated master plan, it's become apparent that more help is needed. As an example, this summer we will open Duluth's first new attraction in 10 years, our alpine coaster, the Timber Twister. It's only the fifth such attraction in the U.S. and the only one of its kind in the Midwest. We plan on moving ahead with other such projects, along with making overdue and necessary improvements to the infrastructure in the next several years. With these large-scale projects, as Senator Prettner-Solon indicated, it is necessary to involve more individuals to participate in the planning and execution of these plans. Spirit Mountain is celebrating its 35th anniversary this season, and we look forward to increasing the board size to continue an active dialogue and gather more information and community involvement about this great regional asset.
Are there questions for Ms. Mattson or for Senator Prettner-Solon?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I understand the concepts of the bill. I'm just trying to make sure that the language is actually working. It's a 1973 law, and if you start on page 1, line 14, the original law, so the terms of the three of the original directors shall be for 2 years, and the term of four of the original directors shall be for. Now we're going backwards in this year, and we're identifying that four of the original directors shall be for two terms, and then now five of the original directors. So, I mean, I realize we're going backwards in time and trying to identify those original directors. Is that the best way to do it, or is there a better way to add two people and have the term staggered without trying to redefine who the original directors were?
Yeah, Senator Prettner-Solon, is it your intent that the two new directors who are appointed will serve what kind of term?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, they will serve three-year terms, and they will be appointed three each year. So that
that's not what it says, though. Isn't it just in the first line, nine directors, and then leave the language in 14 and 15 alone and indicate that that's all you have to do? Mr. McGowan, isn't that all she has to do?
Well, Madam Chair, the intent is to have the two new directors have staggered terms like the original ones, but it is somewhat misleading, and it seems to suggest that these two new members added in 2010 were there from the beginning, and
right.
That's not accurate. So I guess I would include a term.
Do you have a suggestion? Maybe it might be. Is it complicated to correct this?
Madam Chair, I don't think so.
Okay, then can you give us an amendment for Senator Prettner-Solon to consider?
Madam Chair, I would add either at the end of the paragraph or subdivision 2 or just a new sub 2A. The term of one of the directors added to the authority in 2010 shall be for 2 years and the other shall be for 3 years with the designation of the terms made by the mayor of Duluth. That solves the problem.
And then strike the new language on lines 114 and 115. Senator Prettner-Solon, are you agreeable to that?
Madam Chair, that'll work.
Okay. Senator Betzel?
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, I'll move the language as read by counsel, and then also give counsel leeway to obviously make the editorial changes and so forth, so that it's not exactly word for word if the counsel feels that there's a better way to phrase it. But I'll move the language.
Okay. We usually don't like moving concepts, but you did give us language. You think that will work. Is that correct?
I think so, Madam Chair.
I'll move the language, but as I say, if he needs to tighten it up, give the council leeway to do that.
Okay. All right. Is that agreeable to the committee? Seeing no objection. Senator Betzel moves the amendment, which specifies the staggered terms for the new two directors, and which strikes the new language on lines 114 and 115, because you don't need it. Any discussion? All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. And the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 2397 before us as amended. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 2397 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bretner, so on. Senator Cohen? He was here. He used to meet.
Just open a meeting.
Senator Cohen brings us Senate File 2556, and I don't know where the mistake was made, or where the mistake was made, but obviously in the referral line, two words are misspelled, both government and operations. So I don't know what happened there, but it's not government and it's not operations. So I don't know what happened there.
I'm sure. I'm not sure about that. So
anyway, Senate File 2566, Senator Cohen.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, members. This is a bill that I've spent quite a bit of time working with my companion author, Representative Lynn Carlson, along with nonpartisan staff. And that's an attempt to bring the unallotment statute more in conformance with what we feel the original legislative intent was going back 70 years ago. It's striking, and obviously what prompts it is obviously the governor's action from this past spring. And that's not to be critical of the governor. I think that I don't want to be a little bit judicious with comments. I don't want anything to impact on what the Supreme Court is doing or not doing. But I think there's been a sense that the governor took a law that hasn't been utilized a great deal and went a step too far. And this is an attempt to maybe bring back more of a checks and balances approach to the unallotment statute. I should mention that Minnesota has, almost every state has an unallotment statute. And one of the suggestions presented was to simply repeal the statute, which I would suggest is inadvisable for several levels, several reasons, not the least of which is that the bond agencies, apparently the rating agencies, look at the existence of some kind of unallotment statute in an effort to determine the state's ability to deal with financial problems and financial crises. So I think to actually eliminate the statute in totality would be an unwise move. However, Minnesota has probably the most liberal unallotment statute in terms of parameters placed on the law itself. There are none with Minnesota statute. You have about 10 states in the country that have a similar law, but the other states, and I think almost every other state with a couple of exceptions, has an unallotment statute. Have various parameters, including a number of them that actually require the legislature to have to offer some authorization for the unallotment. So what this bill does is several things. And I should mention at the outset that it's not meant to upset the apple cart in terms of what's going on presently. So the effective date, and we had, in fact, Mr. Mossman, who's here now, Mr. Watson, were involved in these conversations. We had significant conversation about an appropriate effective date. And the consensus, what Representative Carlson and I wanted to do was to make sure we didn't impact the Supreme Court litigation, that they can go ahead and do whatever they want, nor to look back at what the governor's done and retroactively change what he had done. So the effective date is effective following the day after final enactment, but also indicates there's also language that's put in the bill that is in there so we don't affect what else is going on and what's happening retroactively. So several of the things that we attempt to do with the bill is to limit the unallotments to 2% of the overall budget, and that would be cumulative during the biennium, but to not simply eliminate whole programs, so to put a limit of 10% on
so,
any...
Senator Cohen, so 2% of This biennium's budget would be how much?
Well, it'd be approximately
600.
No, it'd be more like 750, 760, I believe. Mr. Mossman,
okay. Is that 760? Is that the figure? 34 million billion. Is that right?
Yes. Although keep in mind that our general fund balance gets less and less because of the deficits. Let me comment on that in a second. But if we go back to the governor's action of this past spring, that was a budget of, that would have allowed for about a 760 unallotment. I should make it clear that any future allotments during this biennium would be based upon the general fund budget that we have presently. But something that seemed to be a consensus was that we should not allow for any single program to be eliminated in its entirety. So there's a limit of 10% of any single appropriation. Again, that's cumulative. That's similar to a number of states. Something that I certainly disagreed with the governor is the governor's unallotment, but doing so in a way that, say, in the case of the political contribution refund, putting aside whether or not that's a good idea, a bad idea to get rid of it, the unallotments, clearly, I think the intent, if you look at the history, was to have unallotments deal only with dollars and not to have a situation where a governor could, in effect, change a statute. So the contribution refund is established by state statute separate from the appropriation. So this would make sure that I think the language we have is the governor can't modify formulas, eligibility standards, or statutory criteria.
Is it your understanding that the governor's understanding unallotting the dollars for the political contribution refund repealed the statute?
In effect, it made the statute, if it didn't repeal the statute, certainly made it a null and void statute.
Statute is still on the books.
Statute is still on the books.
No money in it.
But there was a statutory authorization as to how this program would be operated. And the money, I guess I would describe it as the money followed the statute. You know, the money wasn't freestanding in that respect. So this bill attempts to deal with that situation. It also, the other consideration was, and this question of, well, the governor knew that there was a deficit. That was not a surprise to anybody. So his use of the unallotment was a look back at to where we had been. It wasn't the kind of crisis situation anticipated by unallotment where the legislature's out of session. We don't, you know, there's a new budget forecast, for instance. We're going to start running out of money. So this unallotment statute is based upon the budget, what's in the fund, the general fund, at the end of a legislative session, so that if we adjourn and now it appears that there's a new deficit, the governor has the ability to unallot. It also changes the consultation group. Keep in mind that unallotment still remains a consultation with the legislature to the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy. And that was done primarily because right now the governor would come to the LAC. There are no minority members on the LAC. You've got the majority leader. Senate members would be the majority leader, myself, and then depending on the issue involved, that particular division chair. So there's no room for minority members, whereas the Legislative Commission has both majority and minority members. And so it was felt that it would be better to have that group be the consulting organization as opposed to the LAC, so you get a little bit of a broader look at what's going on. So the intent, again, is not to change.
Senator Cohen, who, other than the named offices, who appoints the members of the Legislative Commission on Fiscal and Planning?
The majority of minority leaders do, I believe.
It's not done by the Subcommittee on Committees, is that correct? Our subcommittee on
what? Well, Madam Chair, that's a good question. It's done. I think it has to be approved by the Subcommittee on Committees. I think, Mr. Watson, do you want to help me on this one?
How is that commission?
Try to do it without looking at the computer.
Constituted.
I will turn to Mr. McGowan and ask.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vodden, I think, has the language. For the Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy, its members are appointed by the Subcommittee on Committees in the Senate and by the Speaker in the House. So these are not ex officio people.
Appointed that way. Nobody is named. Is that correct?
Correct.
And are the members of the minority party designated by number? When you say there are members of the minority party on the commission, how many members of the commission are there? I understand your intent, Senator Cohen, but I think we should know that.
I want to say it's about 7 from each body.
What's the total number of people on the committee? I need to know, Councilor.
Madam Chair, the total number is 18, 9 from each.
9 from each body, and then how is it divided between majority and minority parties? Does it say?
On the Senate side, Madam Chair, there are 3 minority members, and on the House, least 3.
So it's 12.
House also 3. 6 and 3.
It's 12 to 6. I mean, just keeping in mind, Senator Cohen, about the makeup of the commission itself, that's all.
Well, Madam Chair, again, I would emphasize that this intent was to have more members of the legislature have some role in talking over on allotments, because now it's only the 3 of us on the LAC.
Right.
And nobody
I
else.
Just want to make sure that people understand, that members of my committee understand how what the makeup of the commission is that you're asking responsibility to be transferred to.
And, Madam Chair, again, it's for consulting purposes. This doesn't take away the authority of the governor to unallot. As I mentioned, I think I've got the list in my file somewhere. I think it's about 12 or 13 states that actually have the legislature have to give approval to a governor's unallotments. So this legislation does not suggest a change at that level. It maintains the present unallotment, but does in a way that I think comports more with what we've always understood unallotment to be. Certainly the exercise of governors in the past has been an exercise that's been more in line with what I think this legislation, this bill proposes, than what happened during the spring. And again, that's not to be critical of the governor. And in fact, obviously, to do anything with this, the governor has to sign the legislation. Representative Carlson and I are going to meet tomorrow, not with the governor, but I think with the commissioner and the chief of staff to talk about the bill and how they would see the unallotment statute. So those are the broad. That's a broad description of the bill. Again, we've had some very lengthy conversations about this and trying to talk around what would work, what would not work, to not take away a governor's ability to deal with a crisis, but to make sure that it's understood to be a crisis and one that doesn't usurp as too strong of a word, but certainly goes too far one direction in terms of kind of a checks and balances approach to it. So I would argue that this is a bill for conservative government, not liberal government.
Are there questions or comments for Senator Cohen? And if we, you don't have the if the committee acts favorably on the bill would be referred to the Finance Committee. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Cohen, I'm trying to understand how this would actually operate if we say that he could reduce part of an appropriation, but he couldn't change the formula or the eligibility standards. So suppose we're talking about the political contribution refund, and he could take out what percent, 10%?
Yes.
Of the total amount. But he can't change the formula. So how would that work then if it's reduced by 10%? Would you just say that after a certain amount, There's just no more refunds. It's over. I'm trying to figure out how we'd set something up like that.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Roland, remember, Senator, there's also a limit on the amount that can be unallotted at 10%. So I've talked about the contribution refund. Let's take a different program that wasn't affected, so maybe that makes it a little bit cleaner. Let's take school aids. Governor didn't unallot anything from school aids, although this does take into the fund balance any shifts or other changes of that sort. But he didn't unallot anything from school aids. Well, there's a formula in place for school aid payments. So the governor could say, I'm going to unallot 2% of the entirety of what's appropriated for school aid payments, but not change the formulas. So you would have, in effect, a 2% reduction then or a 10% if you want to take the maximum, but you'd have a percent reduction to the appropriation, and you would then reset the appropriations accordingly. But you wouldn't change the statutory language relative to the formula that's used.
Senator Roebling.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, I understand it for something big like that, but let's go back to the political contribution refund. So if he can't change the formula, that means he couldn't say of your $50 contribution, you can only get $45 back?
Potentially.
He could say that, or he couldn't?
He could. Because you'd change the appropriation. So let's say the governor wanted to unallot the entire 10% maximum as allowed by this bill. And I think the appropriation, I want to say, has been around $50 million. So the governor unallots $5 million of the 50. We now have left $45 million. So we would assume then that what you would get would be $45 as opposed to $50.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling. And Senator Cohen, you're confident that this language would do that?
Yes.
Yeah. Senator Roebling?
Madam Chair, I'm not as sure because it, to
well, that's
me,
why
it
I
would be
was
changing.
Asking him.
It would be changing the formula somewhat. I mean, or the eligibility standard. I guess it wouldn't change eligibility, but it would be changing the formula in some ways. But let's go to something like GAMC then. So if that were cut 10%, it would just and. Would it mean that people would be capped? Because they're not capped now in what they can get for health services. Would it mean they'd be capped, or would we just say that once the appropriation is expended, nobody else gets any services from it?
Senator Cohen?
I'm sure, Senator, that might be one way of looking at it. I think I want to say the GAMC appropriation was about $400 million, I think. So 10% would be $40 million. I think the governor's on. I'm not sure. Mr. Mossman, what was the unallotment for GAMC?
16. Mr. Mossman, you need to come to the table if you're going to speak.
That's over $500
million. Mr. Chair, members, Matt Mossman, Senate Fiscal Staff. The governor, there was just two things, just to be clear. The governor's veto was $381 million. That was the value of the fiscal 2011 appropriation. The governor subsequently unallotted $15 million, I think it was $15.3 million, of the fiscal 2010 appropriation.
So
we're only talking about the $15 million as an unallotment because he vetoed the other.
But let's, Madam Chair, let's change the hypothetical to what Senator Roebling suggests. Let's say he had done everything through an unallotment. Obviously, let's say hypothetically he had not done a line item veto, but everything was going to be through an allotment. So it's approximately a $400 million program, so he could have unallotted $40 million of the $400 million, would have been limited to that. Again, this is separate from whether or not he was going to exercise a line item veto, because this bill doesn't change anything relative to the utilization of a line item veto. So you have less money to use. You'd appropriate the money as the statute suggests. Then when you reach the end of the money, that would be the end of the program if you were to run out of money at some point. But it would only be, again, a financial issue, not a program issue, not a programmatic issue. So the governor couldn't say in the process of that, as an example, I'm going to unallot $40 million. As a consequence, we're not going to cover this group of people. So for, let's take, I haven't had a chance to pick up the, all the details of his supplemental budget this morning, but let's take what he's done with the Healthcare Access Fund, where he's changing eligibility criteria for access to the Healthcare Access Fund, I believe. I think it affects, for instance, single people, I think, under a certain age. Not sure about that because I haven't picked up all the details, but I think he does something like that. So he couldn't do that in the unallotment. He couldn't say, I'm going to unallot so much and only these people will be eligible. So you maintain whatever eligibility is there, and then the money is proportionally available.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling?
I guess I almost think it would work better if he had some authority, though, to change the formulas as well or the eligibility, because otherwise we could end up with a whole group of people at the end of the fiscal cycle that simply can't get services no matter what their needs or priorities are. Whereas if we rationed it differently earlier on, we would be in better shape at the end for those people who really needed some very basic services. You know, if for example, you could say that you're not going to be doing hip replacements or changing the formula somehow, and so that people could get cardiac services till the end of the year, I think that priorities are important. And sometimes the way we set up the formulas matter a lot because it's all or nothing otherwise.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, you're making the point for the language that's in the bill. First of all, just in terms of your hypothetical, I don't think you're suggesting this, I don't think in statute or, you know, as a legislature, we don't determine does somebody get a hip replacement versus a heart transplant. We don't get into that kind of detail in terms of those programs. But the general point you're making, I think, again, is an argument for keeping the bill the way it is in terms of not allowing that. Because that clearly, if we're setting up eligibility standards, those are clearly standards established through the legislative process. We can pass a bill that says you have to cover all hip replacements. Governor thinks that that's inappropriate. He can veto the bill. We can override the veto if we so chose. But if a governor is given the authority to determine what medical procedures are available unilaterally, that suggests an authority given to a chief executive that we never have done, and that's why I would think this language reflects that. I don't care if the legislature is Democratic legislature, Republican legislature, or something else. If we go back to the old days when there wasn't party designation, it seems to me that that's a conveyance of some real significant unilateral authority to a chief executive that was never intended. And that's what this bill tries to do is to take a look back as to what was intended 70 years ago, take a look at other legislation around the country. And I understand what you're saying, but again, that's, as you've stated it, that's a stretch for a chief executive. Obviously, the chief executive has got a lot of authority with administration of programs, but to act in a way in contravention of what's in statute, you know, that just has not been done.
Any other comments or questions for Senator Cohen at this time?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Senator Cohen, I'm wondering, 70 years ago is a long time, and probably no one is around anymore who helped craft this provision in our state law. So how do we determine what the intention was?
Senator Cohen? Maybe even some indication of how, after it was put into statute, how frequently has it been used?
Madam Chair, we had some discussion on that, and at least recently it's only been used a handful of times. And Senator Roebling, it is difficult to determine what was being done in 1939. I don't think anybody at the table was around or even close to being around for that legislative session. But we had some discussion about what, you know, what seemed to be the utilization. Obviously, you're right. You know, there are no tapes of committee hearings back then or floor debates. You know, we depended on staff to some extent and tried to take a look at what's happened elsewhere in the country where this seems to just be something that the Minnesota statute is, again, very, very, very liberal compared to other states.
And Senator Cohen, was the statute put in place and then because an occasion, in a sense, called for it in terms of a budget issue? Or what was the first time it was used after it was passed?
Ma'am, sure, I don't have the exact history. I think the sense was it was a reflection of what was going on in the 1930s with some real uncertainty in the budget process in the aftermath of the Depression, because that was also around the same time that the income tax was first passed.
Well, and we were also, weren't the legislature also meeting every, one of the things is that it was meeting every other year, and if you had a crisis in that other year and you needed to, and, I mean, you could, I guess a governor could have called a special session, but that would have allowed the governor to act without calling a special session, since we didn't meet every year. We didn't start meeting every year until the 70s, as I recall.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'll defer to Mr. Watson if I'm saying this. But I think the constitutional amendment for annual sessions was on the 72 ballot.
74 was the first year.
74?
Was 74.
Okay. Okay, so that the annual sessions began then in 75, 76.
73, 74.
So the constitutional amendment was 72 then. Okay, I thought that's what I said.
Yeah,
you did.
Okay.
Welcome back.
So the first annual sessions were 73, 74, and certainly that was a reflection of, to be honest, the legislature that at that time was. Well, the legislature that would have passed the constitutional amendment would have been, it was before party designation, but would have been a conservative majority legislature. Which saw the lack of annual sessions as...
Could Governor Quay have used the unallotment statute rather than that series of special sessions in 82?
82, and I think
I mean,
he
I
did.
Realize that they did, you know, different things were proposed that, mm-hmm. like shifts and tax increases as well as cuts, but... If he had wanted to do it all by cuts, could he have done it through an allotment?
Certainly.
I mean, that would have been permitted to him. Is that correct?
Mr. Watson, you were...
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen.
I was curious.
To get back to some of the earlier questions about 1939 and so forth, we do have the benefit of Governor Stassen's budget address, where he laid out the problem that the state was in during the Great Depression. And they had a serious problem, and he proposed to eliminate his deficit, which was about 10% of state spending, by a combination of cutting spending 4% and increasing revenue by over 6%. And he said that the... And this actually caused them to be spending less in the coming biennium than they had in the previous biennium. So a situation similar to where we are right now. And he proposed this authority to have definite quarterly allotments so that they were keeping track of the budget. Every 3 months, they made sure that they were on schedule to not be spending more than they were taking in, keeping things very close to actual receipts, and he asked for the authority to reduce allotments in order to respond in the event that revenues should decrease. So that's why it's there. That's why he asked for the authority, and presumably that's why the legislature gave him that authority. In the 1980s, that was the first time, so far as we've been able to find out, that it was ever used. And Governor Quay did first use his unallotment authority to cut $195 million of spending in the fall of 1980. But after that, I think it was a combination of his learning that it was quite politically painful to him to do that all by himself, and he decided not to do it all by himself anymore. But it also was a problem of you just couldn't get there from here. You could not cut enough in the amount of time left in the biennium to be able to make up all that was necessary.
Because it had already been spent.
And the legislature and the governor were in a situation, you know, one December where they had to pass a bill with both cuts and substantial revenues, an income tax surtax that could be applied to the year just ending and be on people's tax returns when they started filing them in January. They needed that revenue in addition to the spending cuts in order to balance the budget. There was just no other way.
By the end of the year, because they only had 6 months left in the biennium.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, I understand.
A couple weeks left in the year.
Well, that's helpful. Any further questions or comments for Senator Cohen? Senator Betzel? Would you move the bill, please?
Madam Chair, I'll move that Senate file 2566 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Betzel moves that Senate file 2566 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I'm going to get the governor mad at me.
My next.
Prevails.
Yeah, I will. Senator Sieben, would you?
Senator Rest, Senate File 2518 is before the committee.
Madam Chair, I have the A1 amendment, delete everything.
Madam Chair, it looks like this is a delete all amendment. Is this is the?
That's what he said.
This is the first stop that this bill has made.
Yes.
So
it's an author's amendment.
Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Right.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2518 is a Department of Administration recommendation for changes in the open meeting law. And the delete everything amendment reflects conversations that the department is having with local governments who have some issues and others that have some issues with the bill. What I wanted to do today, however, is to get the issue before us with the delete everything amendment so that the parties who are having these conversations are working off of the same document. And after we have some brief testimony, I will move to or ask that the bill be laid over because the issues have not all been resolved. But I wanted to get the issues at least in a public discussion. Just very briefly going through the delete everything amendment, the first section deals with definitions. Section 2 deals with when meetings are closed, what are the obligations of whatever public body it is? What do they have to do in order to have that happen? Section 3 is technical. Section 4 provides a right to the public about being able to view a paper copy of materials that are presented to members in a public meeting. and that if there is a website that the public body, wherever it is, its meeting, has to post the public meeting materials on the website. Section 5 provides that meetings that are open meetings have to be recorded and photographed or maybe recorded and photographed by the general public so that it in a manner that's not disruptive to the meeting. Section 6 that proposes to allow meetings to be conducted by interactive television, including video and any other electronic means. Section 7 is technical. Section 8 is also technical. Section 9 provides for when there are special meetings of a public body that the notice for it is on posted on a bulletin board or in door the public body's usual meeting room, and that it must do it also on in a way that is available to everyone, including on the website of a public body if it maintains one. And then Section 10 is technical. And the impetus for this is that there is a lot of confusion about the open meeting law because most of the changes that have come about in the open meeting law are a result of case law, of people going to court, rather than changes that are made in the statute. So the interpretation is, a lot of it has come about in court decisions, and what the Department of Administration is proposing is to get the results of some of those court decisions placed in statute. And that doesn't mean that everybody agrees on what those interpretations were or how far you can take them. And so that is why the Department of Administration and also the local governments, people that represent a newspaper association and the media are having ongoing conversations. So that's kind of the lay of the land, and then we can hear from the department and anybody else who wants to speak. And then I would ask that the bill be laid over.
Is it Ms. Beyer-Krupinski?
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Lori Beyer-Krupinski. I'm the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division of the Department of Administration. We assist the commissioner with her duties related to both the open meeting law as well as data practices. And as Senator Ress mentioned, the open meeting law has been the source of a lot of case law as well as commissioner opinions, as well as attorney general's opinions, and a lot of public confusion. The open meeting law was created to promote transparency and open government and to allow the public to monitor meetings when public business is being conducted. And that has been significantly changed by the courts. And also, much of the case law is before technology, so our language doesn't really address both the challenges and the benefits of technology, and we try and incorporate both of those while improving access to citizens, both through technology and as well as to address the different concerns we hear both from our citizen as well as our government and media questions about who does this law apply to and when. So we define terms, add some web postings, clarify provisions related to special meetings as well as closing meetings. And as Senator Rest mentioned, Section 1 adds two key things, definitions for what is a meeting and what is a public body, which isn't incorporated into the law right now. What we do is incorporate the quorum rule, which is from 1983 and the Moberg case. So it is when you have a quorum of the public body. So under this definition, and this is where the Newspaper Association and others have some concerns, it doesn't include when a quorum of the body is there just to receive information. So those social and chance gatherings or trainings where a quorum is present wouldn't be an open meeting because they are just receiving information. That the trigger of a meeting would really be when they start to discuss, deliberate, make decisions. And that is, you know, it's a clear, bright line, but that might be too bright of a line or too narrow of a definition to make everyone happy, so we're going to continue to work on it with others to see what we can come up with.
We will also continue to work on how do we allow for, if you want to include receiving information, how do we say if you get an email, you email all of your public body members, they all get it exactly the same time. Did you just violate the open meeting law just by sending them an email? How are we going to make some of those things work? In the old days, you put it in the mail, and you never knew who was going to get it when or who would open it when they'd read it. So we're trying to address some of those challenges that technology presents. This new definition would not impact any more specific provisions, something like what the townships have that give them an exemption from certain portions of the open meeting law that they have and others may have as well. As I think Senator Ress has given you more than enough information on sections 2 and 3, section 4 of the bill really addresses an advisory opinion that the commissioner had, was that paper materials that were sent to members, you could, public data, you could get those. What we had was, well, all the public bodies got, members got an email. So it wasn't printed by anyone. So was that still something that the public should be able to see on that one copy that's waiting at the meeting? So we wanted to make sure to include that. This also includes, where it's possible, web posting of meeting materials. We have heard from lots of local, state and local government on the difficulty of getting things up on the web this quickly, what those might be. So this would say that if you can do it, you will. So the idea of how long something's going to be up and whether or not it's practical. If your webmaster is on vacation for 3 weeks, it's not practical. You're not going to hire a contractor just to do that. We're trying to move this so that more people can have access to these materials, because they also, many of them have data practices obligations to be able to respond to these, and oftentimes using your website is a really good way to both achieve both of those purposes. And it isn't a mandate. It's just, if you can do it and it makes sense, you can do it. Section 5 of the bill, the part about being able to have the ability, if you are a member of the public or the media, to photograph or record a meeting, that is based on a 1972 Attorney General's opinion that said that they, as long as they weren't being disruptive, the public had a right to be able to do that. And we'd like to be able to have that in statute, because we still hear, even, you know, many people can't find that AG's opinion from the 70s. And we have had public bodies who try and control the media's access or say that members of the public can't bring any recording devices in at all. So we just like to make it really crystal clear. Section 6 and 7, what this does is make your current provision around interactive TV meetings more technology neutral, so that the key concept is, if you are having a meeting by interactive TV, it's about being able to see and hear. So it wouldn't matter if it was a video method or a webcam, as long as everyone could see and hear, that would meet the test of this provision. And that is the kind of advice we give people. We have just looked at that technology and saying the key elements are being able to see and hear. So as long as you have picture and sound, it's all good to go. Section 8 is, as Senator Ress mentioned, purely technical. In Section 9, what we do is, as many of you know, given that there is so much security these days, one of the things when you're going to have a special meeting is that you need to post on your principal bulletin board or on the normal door of the meeting room a notice that says you're having a special meeting. And oftentimes, those bulletin boards and those doors are locked down, and the public can't generally walk by. So what we want to say is, if that's the case, so if you have, say, a meeting room in the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, that you're going to have that notice posted somewhere where a member of the public can actually walk by and see it. And that also, if you can, you will also do a web posting of that special meeting notice as well. And then we just clarify that the days means calendar days, so a special meeting notice needs to be posted for 3 calendar days as opposed to business days. And then the Section 10 just incorporates a web notice when a state agency would be required to do a state register publication, because oftentimes the state register can't necessarily publish something as quickly as you might need it for some of the publication requirements. So we just incorporate an additional web notice posting on state agencies alone.
Ms. Beyer-Krupinski, I just was wondering where in the language you mentioned that if you did send out an email to all members of a city council, for example, that would be included, and I didn't
It's in the section that talks about electronic materials, page 2, line 20.
Yep.
So if you've got an email, that's the electronic materials.
Mm-hmm. But that would also include whether you're actually in a meeting or just sending out materials to all city council members regarding a subject under discussion?
Madam Chair, the first part of your question is addressed in that if we just send out an email with information to our members, that would not be considered a meeting. So if a quorum of the body all got the email at the same time, it wouldn't be a meeting. But say all of them did get an email with the meeting materials, and that's the only way they got them, when they come to the actual meeting and there needs to be a paper copy so that the public can see what the members are going to be considering, that's where if there were emails that were sent, those would have to be printed off so that the members of the public could also see the materials that the body, as long as they were public, was considering related to those agenda items.
So, Madam Chair, they couldn't just come to the meetings like many of them do now in city councils and school board meetings with their computers, and just like we do, and are looking only on looking at materials only on our computers. The public wouldn't have that benefit, and so there would have to be a copy of whatever it is that they are considering at the meeting accessible to the general public.
And I assume then that also incorporated in this language, you could not discuss information that's of the public's business over email in an attempt to get around the open meeting law.
Yes.
Via email.
Madam Chair and members, yes. Because once you get into that, you are discussing and deliberating. The commissioner had an advisory opinion around the Metro Gang Strike Force and doing a quorum of them communicating by email to make decisions. And that will still be unallowable under this, but they could have one way, like, here's an article, why don't you read it? That kind of thing versus discussing and deciding would still be off limits no matter how you do that.
Mm. Okay. Senator Pappas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Rist, and I don't see it in this legislation. It must be somewhere else in law that we have an exemption for political caucuses that can have private meetings. They're not subject to the open meeting
somewhere
law.
Somewhere else in law, there's a statement that caucuses of the legislature are not subject to the open meeting law. I don't know where it is, but it's in there.
But that's the entire legislature. That's not like a caucus in a committee, like all the Democrats in a committee or all the Republicans in a committee. They're still subject to the open meeting law.
No, they're not.
They're not.
No, we're specifically exempted. Meetings of legislators are specifically exempted from the open meeting law. Now, we have Senate rules that deal with conference committees, mm-hmm. but that's not in our statutes.
Hmm. Madam Chair, I didn't.
Senator Pappas?
Okay, you did answer my second question then, because I was wondering about floor action where we have amendments that aren't easily available to the public. That seems strange.
Senator Betzold.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Obviously, a lot has changed over the years where we try to discourage the majority of city council members, you know, from going out to dinner before the meeting and, you know, kind of discussing things. But now, and we're talking about emails, but I'm wondering about, does this cover, like, if a couple of city council members are Twittering each other, you know, is that covered? And how do we control that? Because they could very well be exchanging information in new electronic means that we haven't even thought of yet, and it would still have the ultimate effect of having, as though they were sitting down having a meeting prior to the council meeting. So does this still cover, you know, new imaginative uses of technology where they're still trying to get around the open meeting law?
Ms. Beyer-Kopensky, or Senator Rist?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, I don't know that the statutes keep up with human imagination ever, actually. But we're at least at the point of trying to deal with emails here, and that, and I would imagine that we would get to something dealing with tweets based on somebody taking a council member to court and having the court decide whether that's a violation of the spirit of the open meeting law, and then perhaps then, like we're doing, trying to do here, we could incorporate that into a statute. But I just think that's the way our process works.
Senator Bessel.
Except, Madam Chair and Senator Rust, I mean, we know that's a form of technology that exists today,
mm-hmm.
and it wouldn't take too much imagination to figure out how it could be used today to get around the open meeting law. I'm just wondering what the language we have before us, and we don't have to answer it right now because mm-hmm. the bill is going to be laid over.
Come back.
But we should give some thought as to say, okay, if creative minds are going to use the current technology to get around it, does the language cover that or not? And we should give some thought to that.
The word is electronic means.
Okay.
And I don't believe the word email is used. I think just electronic materials, or correct me, where is email?
Madam Chair and members, it may be that the language as introduced made it more clear that it wouldn't matter if the public body met in person or by any electronic means, so that perhaps it might be the language that was introduced was better as addressing that the real crux of it is when they start discussing, deliberating, however they do it, that's going to be a meeting that would be violate the law if a quorum of them start doing it. So if they tweet together a quorum of them and start making decisions and discussing, that would still be a violation of the law. So we will clarify to make sure the language better reflects that.
But Madam Chair, yeah, that's a good point, I think, because we might it's what the result of the communication is, not the means of it, that is and that's being addressed. And electronic means are so prevalent that it makes sense to put that, at least general term, in the statute. Madam Chair, I wonder if we could hear from whoever else.
Ms.
If there's
Aaron,
anybody
I see.
Else who wants to speak on the bill, and then we would ask that it be laid over, and hoping for further resolution of issues that are outstanding.
Ms. Niren is listed on the agenda. Does anyone, or Mr. Neumeister, does anyone else want to speak on the issue or on the bill on Senate file 2518? Ms. Niren, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sandy Niren. I'm from Meserling Kramer, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Newspaper Association. I do want to express my gratitude to both the department and the author who have been more than willing to meet with us and talk with us. We do have some remaining concerns in this bill, mainly dealing with definition of meetings, some of the electronic meeting provisions, and we are looking forward to continuing to work with all the parties to see if we can work out some solution that will work for everyone. But I at least wanted to go on record now letting you know that we don't support the bill at this time in the present form, but it does seem to be improving every time we talk and work on new amendments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Neumeister. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, my name is Rich Neumeister. For those folks who may not know who I am, because I very seldom get to this committee, I'm a citizen who, for a great number of years, decades now, I've been involved on open government issues and privacy and other kinds of issues, but particularly on open government. I became aware of the open meeting law right around 1969, 1970. When I was a sophomore in high school, when I started trying to find out what the superintendent of schools, George Young at that time, in St. Paul was doing about student rights and all that. So I remember starting to go to those meetings, and ever since that time, the open meeting law has been a very effective tool for myself and Minnesota citizens to be able to get information about how they can do their First Amendment right to petition their government and redress grievances, because what is said at public meetings is a very important thing. Now, over those 35, 40 years, there have been a great number of court decisions. because our state law has not had a definition of public, of what a public body is. And that's one of the concerns I have about this proposed definition, that it, in my judgment, does not go far enough to define what a public body is. And I'll give you some examples of that. Just last week, in the city of St. Paul, the city of St. Paul is now going through a search for a police chief. A member of the press and some citizens, I understood, went to the first meeting, an organizational meeting, to find out some general information, how they're going to do the process, how is it going to be organized, those kinds of things like that. They were told at that time, again, this is from another party, that they were asked to leave, and there was a little blurb put on the newspaper blog in that regard. So those kinds of meetings, I think it should include that. Secondly, there was an opinion done by the Commissioner of Administration three years ago, that where the City Council of Minneapolis created a work group or a task force to take a look at what the strategies should be to develop about the RNC convention when it comes to town. And as you know, that's, there's a strong interest in citizens to know about how that happens. Well, the City of Minneapolis folks believe that that should be closed, or they had a question to that, so they went to the Commissioner of Administration for an opinion, which legally gives opinions about the open meeting law, and they were told they can close that meeting. The open meeting law does not apply. So then I tried to go back in those opinions and court opinions, and I sort of get an idea of why, you know, if we're going to put some court decisions in and case law into the bill, that maybe that is not the appropriate case law, but maybe it should be expanded. Now, one of the examples about that, what I was telling you about and why that group in Minneapolis could not meet or would not be open to the public, because some rationale was, is that it was not capable of exercising decision-making powers of the governing body. But as we all know, and that was from a court case that was used as some rationale, but we all know, as most of us, and I'm sure you, all came up from the grassroots, probably on the local level, and at least, you know, were those little task force groups or those little things like that, to where they're maybe not making any decision, but is maybe some type of body directed by a governing board or a city or whatever to talk about some issues, but that's where you get the germs of the ideas. That's where you get to know, you know, where it starts. And so I think those kinds of meetings need to be open to the public. Now, there was another case in 1988. It was the Minnesota I think it was the Star Tribune versus the Minnesota Daily. And there was an advisory committee made up of the regents, not necessarily including regents, but an advisory board to take a look at what should the qualifications be, those kinds of things in general, should be for the new president, because they were going to select the president at that time. Well, there was a case, a court of appeals case, that said, well, as long as it doesn't have certain kinds of things and they're not making a decision in a couple of other standards, it does not need to be open to the public. Now, I think those type of groups, and in those kinds of situations, ad hoc groups, task force groups, or whatever, should be open to the public, because that's where I and you and the people you represent are able to be guaranteed their First Amendment right to petition and redress government. Because if the information or the discussion, the free-for-all discussion, cannot be heard because it's a closed meeting or that meeting does not apply under the law, it can have an impact on the ability of that, generally in the long run, of the public body, the elected public body, to come up with some...
Senator Rest, If a under your legislation, if a city council establishes a working group to discuss and make recommendations to a city council on a particular issue, would that situation be subject to the open meeting law in your in this language, or is that your understanding? Even if they don't
seems
have
to
a,
me that
even
the,
if they don't have a quorum of the
term,
city council.
In the definition of public body, refers to a committee or subcommittee or, quote, other similar body. And, you know, that might be, too wide open or too narrow to include the kind of groups that Mr. Neumeister is talking about. But a committee or subcommittee, I mean, you could start naming all different kinds of groups, you know, advisory groups, task forces, and so on. And I think the catch-all phrase has been in the delete amendment has been that it is a, well, even in the original legislation, the phrase or similar body and discussing what a public body, the definition of a public body. But it's those kinds of things that he, that those kinds of groups that he's bringing up that are, you know, ones to be concerned about as well for the reasons that he gave. But, you know, at this point, I think we've heard the testimony from the newspaper associations, the local governments are concerned about mandates that may or may not be costly to them. And the Department of Administration is looking to update the law, and that's what this bill is trying to do. So I will be, you know, welcoming any participation or ideas from any of you, as well as the department as we continue the discussions on the bill. And unless members have more questions, I guess at this point I would request that it be laid over.
Mr. Neumeister, did you have any closing thoughts?
Yes, I do.
Briefly, please.
Quickly.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I just share a Supreme Court decision, one of the most recent ones, that said that that the University of Minnesota does come under data practices and open meeting laws. Talks about what a public body generally should be. The most possibly the broadest expression, a group, the public body, whether it be a task force, that performs functions for the public benefit. The public body definition needs to fit that. And one other last thing is that when you mess with these kinds of things, I'll give you the example. The Supreme Court had to define what attorney-client privilege should be. It should be defined. It was very narrow as an exception for the open meeting law. The legislature put in attorney-client, thinking that they were saying what the case law was. Well, what happened, that caused a fair amount of confusion with out there in the cities and places, and it took 4 years for that new language to be litigated again, to go back to the limited exception or the narrow interpretation what the Supreme Court did. So I'm just saying that when you do those kinds of things, we've got to make sure on the record what it really means also. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Neumeister. Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Senator Rest, at this time we'll lay over Senate file 2518.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for your patience. Our hearing today has allotted some time for discussion of early voting. the policy of early voting, about which there's a lot of interest across the country and participation in an early voting system by a number of states. And Senator Sieben has been following that policy very closely and in detail, and so she's going to be making a presentation today and also has invited some people to come and talk about early voting. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for your time today. If the committee will recall, last year we did pass Senate File 970, which was an early voting bill. It subsequently was included in overall omnibus elections bill. Was the early voting provision was dropped in conference committee, and so this bill or Senate File 970 is actually before the Finance Committee right now. It's already passed this committee, but just out of respect for the committee members and you, Madam Chair, I wanted to have this hearing just to remind members of the issue because
so we didn't ask for the bill to come back here.
Right, I just.
Just to make sure people
because it is a
that.
Substantial policy change, I just wanted to give the committee the option to discuss the issue here today. So, members, I'll try to be real brief and then turn it over to the testifiers. But just to remind members, in the last U.S. Senate election, Minnesota had very high turnout. The highest turnout in the country. There were 2.93 million ballots cast, and 12,000 absentee ballots were rejected. 1,200 of those were improperly rejected, and 10,800 were properly rejected. So if you think about it, the difference separating Senator, now Senator Franken, and former Senator Coleman's margin of difference was far, far less than the number of, again, over 10,000 ballots were properly rejected. And I think one of the major reasons to institute an early voting system in Minnesota is because it would reduce the number of ballots that are rejected, because for the simple reason that when a voter would go to vote, instead of casting an absentee ballot, which they do now, if a voter says that they're going to be gone from the precinct or marks another reason for why they are casting an absentee ballot. instead, the voter would be able to vote early, essentially, therefore, thereby cast a regular ballot instead of an absentee ballot. So I think, as we've seen, the number of absentee ballots cast has gone up significantly over the past elections. It would cut down on the number of votes that were cast by absentee ballot. I think the reality, which we all experienced in the last election and in other elections, is that political parties and candidates are encouraging voters to vote early. They even will call it early voting, even though what they're encouraging voters to do is vote by absentee ballot. So, I think, you know, there are many, many discussions that we've had in the past over convenience and the simultaneity of elections and how that issue can be resolved, and that is certainly something I'm happy to discuss more. But I do, the compelling reason here is I think it's time for Minnesota's, what Minnesotans are doing in practice, which is voting early by absentee ballot. It's time for our system to catch up and actually allow those people to vote by a regular ballot, not absentee ballot, but indeed to get their voting done early. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mike Dean from Common Cause.
Mr. Dean, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. We're a nonpartisan government watchdog group. It's now been over a year since the 2008 U.S. Senate recount, and we've had time to reflect on the lessons learned from that experience. The most glaring problem of that election was the 12,000 rejected absentee ballots. Many of the errors resulted from confusion over voter registration status and from many individuals improperly filling out the absentee ballot forms. We believe that the state really should look at ways to reduce the voter confusion. Senator Sieben highlighted many of the reasons why we should adopt an early voting system. But we wanted to present some of the human reasons why we think these reforms are necessary. Over the last several months, Common Cause Minnesota has been speaking with many of the individuals that had their ballots rejected as a result of the 2008 election. Many of those voters feel frustrated and disenfranchised because they are now just learning that their ballot was in fact rejected during the election. For example, we spoke with Marcella Adams, a retiree from New Germany, who voted absentee because her husband was to undergo knee surgery at the end of October. Her ballot was rejected because the address given by her witness, her daughter in this case, didn't match her address in the voter registry. Her daughter did not re-register to vote after she had moved, and because of this technicality, Marcella's absentee ballot was rejected. Marcella's told us that she supports early voting because it would give her the peace of mind to know that her vote was counted. The 2008 left many people questioning the absentee ballot process. These voters felt that they did everything right, only to learn months later that their ballot was rejected. That's why voters in 31 states have used early voting and like it. Republican, Democrat, and independent voters are coming together to support early voting. And in front of you, see, we have 600 individuals that have stepped forward, and these are individuals that had their ballots rejected during the 2008 recount and are urging elected officials to support not only early voting but absentee ballot changes. And that's because they really understand the need to pass these critical reforms to ensure that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. We spoke with many voters who also just want an easier way to participate in the process. Minnesotans lead very busy lives, and we need an election system that offers more convenience. I'd now like to have a few other voters share their experiences that they had during the 2008 election. Mr. Dennis Hansen and Tammy Carpenter, if you wouldn't mind stepping up.
Thank you.
Mr. Hansen, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the
record. Thank you, Madam Chair. Distinguished members of the committee, I don't know any of you. You don't know me.
Mr. Hansen, you do need to say your name for the record.
I will.
We do need to know you.
I'm going to let you know who I am, and I'm going to give you an idea of who I am. And I'm going to read this because I don't often sit in front of a distinguished group like this, but my name is Dennis Hansen.
Thank you.
I'm a retired educational and clinical audiologist of 40-plus years. My wife, Mary, and I live in Woodbury, Minnesota, and she's a teacher. Now, so you know a little bit about me. In my profession, I have worked with all ages, from babies to those in their 90s. I've taught in college. I've delivered Meals on Wheels to shut-ins in 20-degree below-zero weather, as you probably all know. I have sat holding the hand of a dying man as a hospice volunteer. I was a young Republican in college. I was a campaign manager for a Democratic Iowa State legislator. I have been a volunteer on election days. I am one of the quiet majority of Americans who despise partisan politics. I am an American citizen just trying to do his part. I want you to know that I admire and respect all of you for your service. My parents are lifelong residents of Minnesota who live in Tracy and Winter in Arizona. They are presently 90 and 95 years old and need help in their travel. Because I'm retired and live in Minnesota, I am able to escort them to their Arizona winter home in October each year. In October 2008, before the national election, I went to the public offices in Woodbury, Minnesota to vote as an absentee because I had planned to stay with my parents to help them get settled, thereby being out of state on election day. I was given a ballot, told to fill it out and return it to the people at the desk. I found no difficulty following the directions and completing my ballot. I returned it to the desk, placed it in the envelope, provided, and handed it to the clerk. I left proudly, assuming I had done my patriotic duty for another historic election, just as I have by voting in every election since the 1960s. Sometime during the Minnesota senatorial election recount, I received a telephone call informing me that my vote had not been counted. How would you feel? I'm not sure who called me. However, something that was said made me believe it was from Senator Norm Coleman's office. The The person asked if I could come and make a statement. At this point, I was dumbfounded. And after determining that this was not a prank call, I quickly became incensed. I was so confused by the information that I said I had not voted for either Coleman or Franken and did not feel my presence would mean anything. The caller hung up. However, as time went on, this revelation continued to irritate me. My concerns are, how often does this happen? Were all my votes for not, or were some counted and others tossed aside? Did my vote for president, state and federal legislators count? Are there really a few people who control the voting process? I hope not. And yet now I find out that it doesn't make any difference if you vote in Minnesota, because there's a good chance it could be thrown out for some obscure reason. I don't even know what my reason was, why mine was thrown out. I know this isn't about me. I'm just a citizen going about his life with little recourse, but with the expectation that my citizenship should be honored. My vote should count just as much as your vote. I am encouraged to find out that there are citizens who are very concerned about our Minnesota voting system as well. I'm thrilled to come and talk to those who I hope can do something about this travesty. The question is, what can you as legislators do to, or senators, do to resolve this problem? From my perspective, it is time that you enact an early voting policy which would allow voters like me the right to vote and be assured that their vote would actually be counted and mean something. I feel it would reduce the number of absentee ballots while saving money, time, and confusion. If you do nothing, it is a simple message to me and the state. When out of the district, do not waste my time again. And yet, after all is said and done, it may make the difference of you getting reelected. Thank you for your time and concern.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Are there questions or comments from Mr. Hansen? And Mr. Hansen, we really do appreciate your taking the time to be here. And in addition to Senator Stevens' bill that deals with early voting, we are undertaking, and she is the author of that as well, a bill that on absentee balloting that I think a lot of us hope will, for that particular process, will result in there being fewer opportunities to make, quote, mistakes, and that it will be clearer to the voters as well as clearer to elections officials that accept the ballots who, quite frankly, do the best they can. It is not partisan politicians who accept or reject absentee ballots. I want to make that quite clear to you. These are
And I do understand.
These are elections officials, and they are not there as partisans. But thank you very much, Senator Pappas, and then Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just saying out loud what I think is the case, that when you vote a regular election, if there is something wrong with your ballot, it's immediately rejected. And that's the advantage then, right, to voting. Whereas an absentee ballot, that's counted at a later time, and you don't have the opportunity to correct what might have been wrong with it. Am I right with that?
Senator Pappas, depending on how early your absentee ballot is, the outside envelope, if there are mistakes on that, you might not even get to the point of your ballot being counted.
But, Madam Chair, I think, Senator Pappas, that's the general one of the major reasons why I thought that why this system is needed, because if you can vote in person early, mm-hmm. then you actually feed your ballot into a regular tabulator,
mm-hmm.
and you know how the machines will spit out the ballot if it's in some way spoiled, if the marks aren't filled in correctly or something. However, if you complete that similar ballot by an absentee ballot process, it's much more unlikely that, or it's much more likely that it will be rejected by either an absentee ballot board or under the current process, because even if you vote incorrectly, for instance, then you don't get that same option where the
to replace it.
Correct, right. Because you're just turning in the ballot, and it's. Now, like Senator Rest said, a lot of the problems that we saw in the past recount will be addressed in the absentee ballot bill, which we're going to hear in the committee on Wednesday. But, for instance, there's a provision in there that will say that if your ballot is rejected, if your absentee ballot is rejected and say you voted absentee on election day, then you will get a postcard or a mailing stating why your ballot was rejected, mm-hmm. which would is just one.
So at least you know.
Right, because you said, Madam Chair, Mr. Hansen, you said you didn't know.
I have no idea, and I would like to know.
But somebody called you and said your ballot was rejected.
That's why I thought it might have been a crank call. I had no idea who it was. It came up during the recount. So... took me out of the blue. Like I said, how would you feel?
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Exactly, I wanted to explore that exact point about how do we know. We're working on some bills here, and one of the key items is to understand why absentee ballots were rejected, to find out those reasons and try to iron those out. But, Mr. Hansen, you say you have no idea why. I would think that if I got a call like that or somebody said your ballot didn't count, the first thing that would pop into my mind would be, well, why? But you didn't ask why and you didn't pursue
that. I may
that
have,
at all.
But I don't think they had an answer for that. It took me so by surprise that I wasn't even sure that it was a real person, that was legitimate.
Okay, and Madam Chair.
Senator Gerlach.
What, Mr. Hansen, what would make you think today that it's legitimate? If at the time, I guess I'm just wondering, you got a call, and how do you know today that your ballot was in fact not counted?
Mr. Hansen.
You really don't know. It could have been counted, but because you're not
all
sure.
All I
called
have
you.
To go by is
your
what
phone call.
They said during the,
So Madam Chair, someone called you, Mr. Hansen, and they said, hey, your ballot didn't count, but you don't know who that was.
Right.
You don't know that wasn't an election official of any sort. It doesn't sound like, or you're not even sure.
I'm not sure.
You don't know. So you.
But how would they give my name?
Chair.
What's that? I'm sorry?
Our guests don't know the procedures all the time, but you need to go through the chair.
Yes. So, well, Madam Chair, then. I would suggest, Mr. Hansen, maybe you should find out some more of the facts on that. I mean, if we can trace back and find out precisely if your ballot was rejected and why, I think you can figure that out. I think,
Madam Chair, would that be possible?
Be in the dark about that.
I would think so, and I had an additional question as well. How much earlier than the election day did you actually hand your absentee ballot in?
I don't know. I left the state.
I mean, was it
October 22nd?
If it was like a couple of weeks or so on,
it was around the 15th of October. I'm not exactly sure.
Well, if it was the ballot itself, then you wouldn't know that it was rejected until election day. But if there was something the matter with the application, then the city clerk should have called you and informed you that your application was that there was an error on it and invited you to come in and correct the error, because they do that routinely. And in the absentee ballot bill that we will be considering, that's going to be a requirement, as a matter of fact. Mr. Hansen?
Where would I go, madam?
I would, we're going to find out, but there's a representative here from the Secretary of State's office, as well as she should be able to tell us, you know, to go to your city clerk, or where now maybe it's with the county auditors. I'm not sure where the ballots are now that would be able to. But Ms. Fraser's coming forward. Senator Stephen, if you don't mind, would that be okay?
Sure.
Just for a minute.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And we can work with the Washington County officials to find out why your ballot was rejected.
Thank you. Do you want me to come back then?
No, we'll get
yeah, we'd like to know.
Any other questions or comments for Mr. Hansen?
Madam Chair.
Senator Gerlach.
One last quick comment, Mr. Hansen. I think you could rest assured that there's a lot of people working on a lot of fixes for a whole lot of issues that were raised during the whole recount and court contest. This is one proposal that has some proponents and some opponents, as well as a whole range of other things. But I think, and we've discussed a few of those things, about notifying people about their rejected ballots so that they can make those corrections and such. So one way or another, we're going to get at a lot of the causes of the rejected absentee ballots.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hansen. Ms. Carpenter, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record, and then we'd be pleased to have your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tammy Carpenter, and I'm simply a citizen of Plymouth, Minnesota, who's here today because I feel I represent many Minnesotans who would be shocked to find out long after the fact, much like Mr. Hansen, that the steps they took in 2008 to cast their vote in the election were not successful. The 2008 election to me was not only historic, but an important turning point in the country from my view, and it was very important for me to voice my voice to be heard in the process. Unfortunately, in 2007, the company I was working for was purchased by an overseas corporation, and since that time, I probably spent more time on planes than in my local office, so it's necessary for me to cast an absentee ballot in the 2008 election, as well in 2009, I might add. I submitted the absentee ballot request and obtained the necessary documents shortly thereafter. As a working mother of two teenagers, you can imagine the whirlwind of activity in our home on a regular basis. I specifically remember sitting in my office, wading through the documents in an attempt to be sure I followed all the key steps in the process. It was 12:30 in the morning, the typical time for me to get things done when everyone else was asleep. I remember making my choices, signing the form, placing it in a variety of different envelopes, signing those, and placing it into my mailbox. Long after the election was over and months into the recount process, I was informed that my ballot had been rejected because my, quote, signatures did not match. I have no idea what signatures those were. I have no idea how they could possibly not match since I was the only one that signed them. But I was extremely angry and frustrated that in one of the most important elections in history, my vote became meaningless. I was also shocked, given the fact that I'm a vice president of a large corporation responsible for budgets in $50 million ranges. I have two Bachelor of Science degrees from the University of Minnesota and an MBA from the University of St. Thomas. And I have to admit that my first thought was, if I didn't get the process right, how did the average Joe do it? My anger was further fueled by the reason given, my signatures didn't match. How in the world could my signatures not match? To this day, I would still like to see this quoted mismatch. And as a professional working for an international company in a global economy, translate that to be available 24/7 for questions from the overseas office, the fact that I didn't sign my name exactly the same after getting typically 4 hours of sleep a night is not shocking to me in any way. Because the Senate seat was decided over just a few hundred votes, I also wondered how many of us who were tossed out could have changed that outcome. This frustrated me even more. I had a right to vote, I exercised that right, and ultimately found out that my efforts were meaningless long after it was too late to correct the problem. The paper absentee process is clearly flawed. People should be given the opportunity to vote at a local office a week or ideally two prior to the election with the proper identification. If we're so concerned about fraud in elections, then we should require people to show proof of identification at the polling location. With today's global economy, the need for absentee voting will only increase as travel requirements for professionals such as myself escalate. I have to admit that filling out the paperwork and placing it into the variety of envelopes seemed like a really silly task, and it actually reminded me, and I thought of the days of voting with old wooden boxes and women in big hats. I also voted by absentee ballot in 2009 so I could vote yes to support my school referendum. And I now wonder if that vote even counted. Good news is the referendum passed. Voters should not wonder if their efforts to voice their opinion are accepted and thus count. Early voting would allow busy business professionals like me, who really have no choice in the travel time zone, a convenient time, allow them to vote at a convenient time that works in their schedule and have the confidence that their vote would count. Although this is really not enough, it's surely a step in the right direction. I've lived in this state since the day I was born. And although many companies have attempted to transfer me for advancement, I have weighed those opportunities for my family because I believe, I love this state and we have our priorities right. This is the first time I've stepped out in the political arena other than to simply cast my vote. And I'm here now because it is my right to vote. And it's my responsibility to take care of my family and contribute to society. And the only way to do this is hard work. And today that means travel and it means missing elections. And if this typical Minnesota work ethic should stand in my way of exercising my right to vote and make a difference for my kids, we do not have our priorities straight. Thank you.
Extremely well spoken. Thank you very much, Ms. Carpenter. Are there comments or questions that the members have for Ms. Carpenter? Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I just want to say how impressed I am with both the speakers and how passionate you are about voting. I mean, it really is kind of encouraging about.
Did you have to audition? I mean, you're really wonderful, both of you.
I wish all our citizens felt that passionate.
Indeed. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Carpenter, I was curious, how were you informed? Was it the same way? You got a phone call from somebody from one of the campaigns?
I got several phone calls. I got the first phone call, probably very similar to Mr. Hansen, and then I did get a call from the Republican Party. So, yes, I got it notified two ways, and I was clearly told that my signatures didn't match, but they didn't know what signatures were.
Okay. Senator Gerlach, further?
No further.
Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, Ms. Carpenter, I think what Senator Pappas said earlier, I think, reflects well for me, too, is if you can stand there and put the ballot in and it, you see the clicker go that it's counted your ballot, and then you know. And so I also appreciate the testimony today because I think you guys are on the right track with the suggestions.
Anyone else? Thank you very much, Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Stephen, I want to also support this. In my career, I had to do a lot of traveling, and a lot of it was at the last minute. And I can, the time when I most remember it is 1998. I put off traveling. I found out on Monday evening that I had to travel, had to be in Florida, and I waited specifically because I didn't have time to go get an absentee ballot. I waited specifically until the next morning so that I could vote in the election, and went to Florida. I had no idea what had happened here, and with all the traveling and meetings, I didn't hear any of the state results. Called my home the next morning to ask who won the governorship, and my son, who was a young kid, said, Jesse Ventura. And I said, come on, Dave. And he said, no, Jesse Ventura. I said, Dave, who won the election? And he said, Jesse Ventura. And I said, put Mom on the phone. And that's something where I think that we need to have something like this where you can be confident that your vote has been counted ahead of the time, and especially with these days with so many people traveling at such short notice, we need to have another option.
Thank you very much. Next we have a representative from the League of Women Voters, Ms. Laura Frederick Wang. Hmm? Oh, we have two League of Women Voters. I'm sorry, Ms. Nelson?
Actually, Jerry had a family emergency, so she won't be here today.
Ms. Frederick Wang, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura Frederick Wang, and I am the Legislative Coordinator for the League of Women Voters, Minnesota. We support early voting because we are committed to ensuring that the right to vote is guaranteed and accessible for everyone. In the days and weeks leading up to the election, we handled over 5,000 phone calls from voters seeking information about where and how to vote. Because so many people had heard about it in the news, a common question from voters was, do we have early voting? When told that Minnesota does not offer early voting, their follow-up question was often, why not? Many of these callers were hoping to vote early because circumstances that many of us with busy lives and unpredictable schedules can understand. Their business required travel at short notice. They were caring for an elderly parent and did not know from day to day what the demands would be on their time. Or they were dealing with their own health problems that make some days better than others to stand in line and cast a ballot. Minnesota allows voters with one of four valid excuses to vote by absentee ballot. It is an increasingly popular way to vote. None of the cases identified above constituted a valid reason to cast an absentee ballot, requiring voters with legitimate barriers to either misrepresent themselves on an absentee ballot application or to become disenfranchised. In 2008, as we know, nearly 300,000 Minnesotans voted absentee. For some voters, absentee voting is the only way they could cast their vote, but for many, early voting would have been a better option. Early voting could reduce the number of absentee ballots cast and the number of potential errors. Jerry Nelson, who was our first vice president of the league and an election judge from Champlin, had hoped to be here today but had a family emergency. She was going to testify about the many absentee ballots election judges have to reject on election night due to honest mistakes that would have been caught had the voters been able to cast their ballot in person. Early voting would not only make it easier for more people to get to the polls, but also ensure that more of the votes cast would not be counted. And I should add also, although Jerry was not able to be here today, our co-vice president, Gwen Myers, is also an election judge. And she, although not prepared to testify, is willing to answer questions if anybody has them. We urge the legislature to allow Minnesota to join the over 30 other states who already offer some form of early voting. In those states, voting early has become increasingly popular and makes the way we vote more consistent with how many Americans live their lives in the 21st century. Thank the committee for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Frederick Wang. Are there comments or questions for her? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, there's many things I like about early voting, but there is a drawback in that you can't take your vote back once it's cast. As with absentee ballots, if you come in before the ballots are counted on election day, you can withdraw your vote and vote differently. You know, we've only had a few instances where candidates have dramatically changed, but one was pretty recent in our state with Senator Wellstone. And if we had had early voting then, I don't know exactly how we would have handled it. We did leave people who had cast absentee ballots to come back and pull those ballots if they were in town and re-vote. I don't know that there's any way to get around that. Do you think people, however, would challenge their ability to recast their votes? And if we had early voting, do you think that could become a problem that they would say, we have kind of been disenfranchised because now we have different candidates on the ballot if something like that were to occur?
Ms. Frederick Wang.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I think situations like what happened back in 2002 are extremely rare. I'm not certain what kind of a procedure would have to be. There would most likely have to be some sort of a procedure to deal with a circumstance like that. But I do think that those circumstances are fairly rare when you look at the number of elections we have and the number of circumstances that do come up that sometimes make it difficult for people to cast their ballot.
Madam Chair, I see Ms. Fraser there. I'm wondering if she has a response to that, especially as it might pertain to how other states have handled it, if any circumstances like that have arisen.
Ms. Fraser, if you would speak to what the HAVA requirements are now, which will have us deal differently with that situation similar situation in which the candidate could not or you know, wasn't able to serve or died or did something before the election day. But there are HAVA requirements with regard to the Americans with Disabilities Act and relative to preparation of ballots that must be able to be accessible. And so that's another sticky wicket to make sure that everybody who's eligible to vote can vote. Ms. Fraser?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling. As the chairwoman was saying, the Help America Vote Act does require that there be accessible voting equipment in all federal elections. And so it would not be possible, were a candidate to die last year or this coming year, to just use paper ballots and change the candidate names at the last minute. We would need to be able to use accessible voting equipment, which takes reprogramming and either printing of additional ballots or changing the ballots. And so I also believe that the MOVE Act, the Military and Overseas Voter Empowerment Act, which was passed this past fall, might also require that we have a 45-day absentee ballot period in that case. And so because of the two federal changes, we could no longer change the candidates at the last minute. So that really wouldn't pose the problem. There couldn't be another Wellstone situation. So if we had early voting, although voters could not change their vote, there would need to be a different election in order to do that race.
A new election.
A new election.
The one, the November one, like this year on November 2nd, if that happened, in that race in which the candidate was removed for whatever reason, would not count.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, the only other option up to the state would be to say, well, all members of a party are created equal. And so a vote for, in this case, Wellstone would have counted for Mondale. Or a vote, you know, in 1990, a vote for
Grunseth
counted for Carlson or something. And it sounds like from conversations with people, they don't feel comfortable that all members of their party are created equal and that they would prefer instead to have an election on the actual candidates. But those are kind of the two options, and the state really does need to take action, because if there were to be a tragedy this fall, I don't know what the state would do. I guess the Department of Justice would probably step in if it were a federal race to require us to have a new election. But we have laws that say both that you have to have these supplemental ballots and laws that say you have to have accessible voting equipment, and it's not possible to do both.
We did have that vacancy and nomination bill that I had that's still on the Senate floor, but it generates some controversy on how you go about doing that, and it ended up not being in Senate file 1331 because people had too many questions about it. But the situation that the bill was a response to is still a very real one and unresolved. But we can't do we hope that's not going to happen. And we're really not able to resolve everything in one session, I think.
Well, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. That whole concept of having a new election is interesting, because I'm just thinking of all the scenarios that could occur. It's either that they would it be that they couldn't serve, or could they just simply withdraw? Suppose during the course of a campaign, some huge scandal came out about a candidate, and they were pressured by their party to withdraw. Then,
in my bill, there were criteria that needed to be met, like somebody dying or having, and this came about because of the Grunseth situation, or having a doctor certify that the person was medically incapable of serving or running a campaign or whatever, so that a mere scandal would no longer be grounds for a candidate to take his name off the ballot. But there are a lot of, there's still a lot of issues with that. And I maybe we're getting far afield here from early voting, but Senator Gerlach, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Frederick Wang, I wanted to explore now the reasons that you must list if you're going to, or you check one if you're going to vote absentee. You, in your testimony, you mentioned that there are people, in the words you used, were legitimate barrier that was not covered in these steps. The items listed are pretty broad. It's just absence from the precinct, illness, there's disability, religious discipline, observance, or holiday. What else here? Or the governor has declared an emergency where it makes voting, going to the polling place on election day, you know, impossible to do. Those are the reasons that could be given. What would be an example that you're familiar with, a real-life example of someone who had a legitimate barrier, as you said, that did not fit into these categories?
Ms. Frederick Wang.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach. Well, for instance, some of the calls that we would get were people who simply did not know. It was a couple weeks before the election. They thought there was a possibility they could be traveling out of town for work. They thought they would be back on election day, but they weren't certain. So when they were asked, when we would ask them, well, are you going to be out of town on election day? Their answer was often, I don't know. Another circumstance that I remember back when in the 2004 presidential election, my own circumstance, I was 8 months pregnant on election day. I did not consider myself to be sick or disabled, but I wasn't quite sure on that particular day if standing in a long line on election day would have been my preference. That's where a circumstance like early voting, a person with a condition where some days they feel good, some days they don't, they maybe don't consider themselves sick or disabled, could pick a good day to go vote.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Gerlach.
Well, exactly to that point, the statute says an elder voter who reasonably expects. So under both those examples you mentioned, a voter could, if they're not sure if they're going to be in town or not, they could reasonably expect not to be in town. Therefore, they would fit under the absentee ballot statute. And if they have good days or bad days, if they have this situation, they could reasonably expect not to be able to vote. So under both of those examples, those were not legitimate barriers to voting absentee. They both, I think anybody's reading this, they would fit and certainly would be eligible to vote absentee. Am I correct in that they would reasonably expect?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Frederick Wang.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach. I think that gets back to another point that has been brought up earlier about the inconvenience of voting absentee ballot and the kind of uncertainty that people have about whether or not their vote is counted. It is simply easier to vote in person than it is to go through an absentee ballot application, fill out the forms, complete the envelopes, and mail your ballot back. And again, the number of errors that we've talked about earlier in the hearing. If you vote in person and you make a mistake, oftentimes that is caught. So it would not just, by early voting, wouldn't just make it easier for some people who have maybe some uncertainties about whether or not they fall under those categories or not. It would reduce the huge number of absentee ballots that we're seeing and also hopefully the number of errors that are happening that are causing some ballots not to be counted.
Okay. Senator Gerlach.
Okay, well then I guess I want to pursue this a little bit because we've drifted from legitimate barrier to the convenience issue. Because we were there with the, I was trying to explore, find out what are the legitimate barriers. But the examples given, Madam Chair, that they would fit, they could certainly reasonably expect to be gone, so they could vote under the absentee ballot. But then we've now drifted to the whole convenience issue. We don't have the bill before us, so I won't give my whole diatribe on the confidence of result versus the convenience and the trade-offs thereof. But just to say that when we discuss the issues and we're trying to, you know, as we've really been in our working groups on working on some of these other bills coming forward, we have really drilled down into the weeds and we have explored to the letter about what signatures need to match and what the process is. We've had schematics and we've followed it. And we are really we're looking for specifics. So if there is a legitimate barrier, we have zeroed in on that to find out, and can we lift this? And so I guess I'm just being honest with you. I'm a little disappointed in that you know, that we said legitimate barrier, but then we really don't have a legitimate barrier to absentee voting. There might be plenty of other reasons, but that doesn't seem to be one of them. And then now we've drifted into the convenience issue, and that's a whole other topic because conveniences can be important. You don't want artificial barriers to voting. You want to, you know, we want a high turnout. We want participation. That's all good. But we don't want to, you know, convenience is not the holy grail of an election system. Confidence result is. Mm-hmm. And so it's just something for us to be cognizant of as we go forward. Let's explore what are the legitimate problems, the legitimate barriers, and what are issues of convenience and efficiency and cost savings and those sorts of things. So that's my very abbreviated spiel on that. But thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, if I could just add that,
Senator Seaman,
if you recall, Senator Gerlach, last year there was a utility worker who was here to testify who said that he didn't think he qualified to vote absentee because he expected to be in town mm-hmm. on Election Day. However, there was an ice storm in Iowa, and so at the last minute, Excel called him to go to Iowa to help fix utility lines in Iowa. So he didn't plan. He didn't anticipate being out of town, or I think the same Ms. Carpenter made similar statements where she doesn't always know if she's going to be out of town, or it's similar to what Senator Carlson said. Sometimes by the nature of our work, voters aren't confident, you know, they can reasonably expect they're going to be here, but there's always the outside chance that they're not going to be here. And so do you want to, I mean, technically if you follow the way, and we talked about this in our working group, if you falsify a voter registration form, you could, no one's ever done this, but you could be convicted of a felony. So you don't want to also, I think the burden is on us as policymakers to remove barriers that that voters could reasonably assume could be problematic, or, you know, they don't want to commit a felony by saying, what's the definition of reasonableness as to whether I can actually be in the polling place? And as we saw in the last election, I mean, in Senator Marty left now, but last year we heard that in Roseville, 17.3% of voters voted absentee. So again, I don't want to stray back into the convenience argument here, but these are people who must have had some reason to think that they were going to be gone on Election Day and actually voted absentee. So I really think that it's time. And I should also say to the committee that I think this is a good segue for our discussion on Wednesday, because I really think that the bill that we've worked on will narrow down significantly those 12,000 absentee ballots that were rejected. But I just think that early voting is another mechanism that we can do to help for voters who are confident of who they're going to vote for or are sure that they want to vote that way. And there is that trade-off that circumstances could change and you could change your mind. And under this proposal, as Senator Roebling stated, you wouldn't have the option to go back and change your vote. You vote early, you're done. You don't get to vote twice or, you know, to switch your ballot. So those are legitimate policy issues that we need to weigh. But at least when I come down and looked at this, I think that enough Minnesotans are voting early right now by absentee ballot, and if we can narrow that number by ensuring that they're casting a ballot that they can see whether it's accepted or rejected at that polling place, that will increase voters' confidence in the election system.
Thank you very much, Senator Seaborn, and once again, Mr. Dean and Mr. Hansen, Ms. Carpenter, Ms. Frederick Wang. I think we had a full discussion, and it indeed is a good introduction to the issues that we'll be taking up in the absentee ballot bill on Wednesday. There
thank
being
you,
no
Madam
further,
Chair.
Senator Seaborn?
No, I just want to say thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. There being no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.
Okay.